Elon Musk quote of whatever he tweeted to the CEO of Twitter at the time, where he was like, what have you shipped this week? That actually is incredibly good for high performance cultures, I think, is to have a sense of urgency and to have an expectation that I do something today. But I think there's ways of bringing that which don't cost people their mental health. When I didn't have cancer, company had loads of funding, and I was in a happy relationship with my ex. Those three things were all true, and the performance of the company was abysmal. Then all three of those things happened, and the performance of the company since has been exceptional.
Problem solved. No. Break up with your partner, get cancer,
yeah,
company success. That.
No, the lesson is the change in how I treated myself because of those major things that happened in my life.
Right, mate. I get people to introduce themselves because I would butcher it. So what should people know about the one and only Jack Rogers?
Good question. How long do people take normally to...
About half the podcast, like 45 minutes.
Yeah. Wannabe professional paddle player. That's probably honestly my identity at the moment. Mostly paddle, but friend. I'm pretty simple life at the moment. I'm single, don't have kids, don't have a pet anymore. So it's pretty simple life.
That's depressing. Me, last point. Don't have a pet anymore.
Yeah.
That's sad.
R.I.P. dog. No, he's still alive. So I'm the co-founder and CEO of Picnic, which is an app that helps you clean up your messy camera roll. And prior to Picnic, I've always worked in the world of consumer mobile applications. So I've worked in dating apps before this. And also businesses in general that had some sort of social element to them. So Viva was another one, which was about finding things to do in London with friends. And then Grabble actually didn't really have much of a social element, but that was just fashion. But they were all mobile apps, and that's what I kind of carved my niche in, was consumer technology.
So after over a decade in consumer tech, even longer, 12, 13
years? Not that old.
No,
actually, I don't know. I don't actually know. You probably know better than I do.
I actually do know, yeah. So happened 2014, 2015.
Yeah, so decade.
So actually a decade.
Decade now.
There you go. Nice. So
if we include Tinder banter, which was the precursor to me getting into tech, which was the Facebook page I made when I was bored in my corporate grad scheme buying toilet seats, then actually it's over a decade.
Go on, what was that Facebook page?
It was a Facebook page called Tinder Banter, which was my conversations on Tinder, which I thought were funny, and it went viral, and that's how I got the job at Happn, because the founder of Happn was a dating app, and it was new dating app on the market, and they wanted to grow in London and different markets, and he reached out to me and said, can I advertise through your page? And I was like, I don't really know what I'm doing, but... And I just graduated from uni, but I had this big Facebook page, and he spoke very bad English. And I just graduated with a degree in French and Russian. So I spoke French and replied to him in French. And then he was like, hold on, you're English, but you speak French. And you know, obviously know a lot about dating apps and also about social media and how to grow things online. Do you want to come and move to Paris and help me grow Happn? And that's how I got the job there.
But you didn't work in Paris for Happn, did you?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, you did? Yeah. But when did you work in Moscow?
That was when I was...
That was the grad scheme.
The grad scheme, yeah.
Okay, wow. Maybe we'll come back to that. But from a decade working in consumer apps,
yeah.
Any highlight lessons that you've taken?
I mean, so many lessons. Basically, you just learn a lot about... user psychology is probably the one thing that you just is the overarching lessons you're learning over a 10-year period, like how lazy people are, how the way that people will say one thing about your product or say one thing about your brand and then actually act in a completely different way, and all of that kind of stuff that you can only learn through doing. That's probably like the main knowledge that you build that is actually like unique, because all the other stuff you can read online, I feel like, but it's only like through building a product and literally sitting down with a user and being like, what do you think? And they're like, it's great. I love it. And then you literally go and watch them use it afterwards, or you look into the analytics afterwards of what they actually did. And it tells a completely different story to what they've just told you all of that stuff is what you learn, I think, over a 10-year period, or you learn it much quicker than that. But that's kind of what I take away from it most of all, is just a deeper understanding than I had of how people actually behave when it comes to like making decisions around the products they use and the apps they download and the money, where their money goes, like when they choose to pay for a subscription or not, all that kind of stuff. That's like the secret sauce.
What's a good example of people being specifically lazy?
I mean, too many. But honestly, the generic example is just literally no one will use your app or product unless it's actually solving a problem for them. And they'll tell you that they want to use it, or they'll tell you that they have every intention of using it, or that they love it. But unless it's solving an actual problem for them, they are way too lazy to use something out of any other reason than pure selfish, this needs to solve some problem for me. And I think like too many consumer founders build things because people tell them that's a great idea or love the sound of that, but not actually solving problems for people. And people are too lazy to just do things that don't give them some benefit in some way. I'm trying to think of an actual specific lazy example, but it's just, yeah. I don't think I have one top of mind. Just the bar is so high for what someone will to actually build a feature of any kind that someone will use is so incredibly high. Like, I think before I started working in this world, I always thought, God, it's so easy. Like, must be so easy to build these apps. Like, why are they all so crap? You know, you just have such high expectations as a consumer, but actually building the products, it is so insanely hard to build anything that anyone will actually use, to break anyone out of their like behavioral patterns and their, you know, habits. To do that even once with one feature is like a marvel that everyone should applaud. But obviously users never do. They're like, this app is shit, it's buggy, it's broken, always moaning about everything. But like the actual respect I have for people who have built big consumer products is much, much higher now that I've tried to do it myself. Because it's so hard. So hard.
What's
underrated how hard it is, probably.
Specifically hard about it that someone who's never built consumer apps wouldn't understand.
The problem with building consumer, not problem, but the interesting thing about building consumer products is that you build something and then everyone has an opinion on it if it's consumer, because they can relate to the problem in some way. So I'm doing photo app at the moment, but I did dating apps in the past, and lots of people who are my friends use Picnic. Lots of people use the dating apps I worked on in the past. So they'd always have opinions about what the product should be like or what they don't like about it. And the problem that most people have in understanding how hard it is to build something really good is they can't put themselves in the shoes of other people. And so they might have a very specific view of like why this isn't a very good idea or why this doesn't work for them. But then we, as the people building the app, need to not just think about you. We have to build something that resonates with enough people and solves enough people's problems. And the problems are always nuanced. So they'll be like, you have this particular type of problem, but there are people who use this app with these problems that we also need to build for. And I think often you just get people go, oh, it's crap because it doesn't do that, or it's crap because it does that. Why does it do it that way? Because they can't think about all the other people that use the app and how what they might need from it. And that's what's always hardest to do, is to actually boil all of those things down into a product experience that does what it needs to do for everyone in an understandable way, in a efficient way, or whatever it might be. It's just really, really, really hard to do it. And that's why basically no one invests in consumer, no one builds consumer apps in Europe, because it's pretty stupid and very much like, I don't know, it's really fun, but it's really, really hard.
So then if we think back to the different apps that you've been building,
mm-hmm.
Happn, Fever, Secret London, Grabble, Chappie, and now Picnic. Two of them were in dating, where it feels like since Tinder, the user experience has been swiped left or right, and mm-hmm. the goal of everyone on the app is to either get laid or get hitched,
mm-hmm.
right? Yep. And so then within those broad brush goals, how would you think about different features that help different users?
Well, Chappie, feel like you know where this question's going with Chappie. But Chappie's USP was that we had a sliding scale where you could choose the mood you're in whether you're looking for Mr. Right or Mr. Right Now. And that was actually the opportunity that led us to actually start Chappie, because the gay dating app market only had apps focused on one thing, which was the hookup element. But, you know, the gay community has evolved over the last 30, 40 years to the point where now you can get married, you can have kids, which you couldn't do back in, you know, 30 years ago or whatever. And so because of that societal development, there was an opportunity to actually build an app that reflects the hookup side of the spectrum all the way through to the actual long-term commitment spectrum. And then that's why we came up with the sliding scale for Chappie, which was, yeah, you choose Mr. Right or Mr. Right Now. And then if I choose Mr. Right, I'll only match with people who are looking for that. If I choose Mr. Right Now, then I'll only match with people looking for that. And that was the innovation. But I don't know if that was where you were going with that question, but
I love it anyway, because that just shows a very good awareness as to the changing tide of things within like just consumer preferences and the world. So, and actually like riding off that
a wave of some kind. That's always a good place to start. In fact, almost a prerequisite for most breakout consumer things is finding a wave of some kind to ride. And often you might have an intuition about what that might be, but you can't put your finger on exactly what the wave is yet. You just know you're on it. And then later on, when you look back, you're like, oh, that was the wave we were riding. Or like, I can put a title to it now or a name to this wave. But at the time, you're just like, feels like this is a good idea. Don't know why yet, but it does feel like it. And then, yeah, you figure out later, like, oh, yeah, of course it was a good idea or a terrible idea because there was no wave.
And then you wrote a Forbes article about TikTok and how they... I was thinking about them when we're thinking about this, when we talk about this wave, mm-hmm. and their wave fit felt like COVID was their wave.
Yeah.
But then again, in the article, you go into detail as to how they engineered the app very intelligently to focus on these ancient parts of ourselves in dance and laughter. And that was like the focus around the platform.
Synchronized dancing, laughter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Singing. What are they called? Striving behaviors, which is... basically how we used to mate when we were primates by, you know, picking and literally
grooming
each other. And then that wasn't efficient enough, because if you've got say 20 of you and I have to go manually round each person and go one at a time and go, oh, it's quite a lot of effort for me. And the grooming was the way that people bonded. And then that's how you knew you had strong social relations with these other primates, because you were groom each other. But at a certain point we evolved and we said, well, what if there was a way where we could actually bond with everyone here at the same time without me having to manually go around grooming? And that's how dancing, laughter and singing became bonding mechanisms for bigger groups of people. So you could, I laugh, you laugh with me, you laugh with me, now we're all bonding. And there is actually endorphins released when we laugh, we sing or we dance, because that's from that era where we were actually using it as a bonding mechanism at scale, which I thought was very interesting. But I probably butchered the science there, or I've said it in a very silly way, but that's ultimately where it comes from. And I think TikTok did really well to leverage that. I don't know whether it was intentional or not, but I feel like it kind of might be one of those things where they didn't necessarily look at the science of it, but it just happens to be that the things people like the most are videos that do those things, and therefore they focused around those things. But there is a reason why people like those things, and that is it's to do with evolution.
And so what's the evolution behind helping people with their photo sharing?
Well, the photo sharing thing comes down to, we tried first, so when I first started Picnic, we started in 2019 and we spent the first 3 or 4 years. The mission from the very beginning of the company was to make the world better friends. So I've always been very passionate about basically building tools for people to actually strengthen and maintain their friendships, because I don't think many of the tools we use at the moment actually do a very good job of doing that. There was a period where like Facebook was really actually quite good for it. And like back in the, I could kind of think of them as the glory days of Facebook. I'm an old millennial at this point, but like back in the early days of Facebook where you would just like go on Facebook. You didn't care about like being cancelled or anything like that. None of those concepts even existed. You would just go on Facebook. You'd literally just post what was on your mind as a text, being like, going to the pub later, anyone want to join me? And then a friend would be like, love to. And then a random friend that you haven't seen in ages would comment and say, yeah, I'll see you down there. And then afterwards, you'd post a bunch of pictures without thinking about it back onto Facebook. And that was like a really wholesome era of social technology. And genuinely, Facebook nailed it at that point in time. But then came the kind of like commercialization of the whole concept and turning it into what it is today. And basically over that period, I think, you know, Instagram came along and other social platforms have come along. But ultimately, there's been this big shift away from connection and towards entertainment on all of these platforms. And so when I started Picnic, which was now 5 years ago, I'd say we were pretty early to the trend of it moving towards entertainment. Like TikTok wasn't really a thing at that point in time, if I remember correctly. Or it was in its very, very early stages. But I could just tell that, like, from my own use, Instagram wasn't making me feel very good about myself, because I was just constantly comparing myself to people that were completely unrealistic, weren't my friends, and were only posting the best filtered versions of themselves online. And I stopped posting on Instagram, and just organically stopped posting. So I was like, well, that's kind of weird, because I used to really enjoy posting, and for some reason now I don't. So now I'm now depriving my friends of what I'm up to, and they're depriving me of what they're up to. And things are shifting away from Instagram towards like private group chats. And so anyway, a lot of these kind of trends were happening, and I basically had just left the dating world, and I kind of was like, I want to be a founder again. I want to do something really, really cool. I want to build a social app that actually brings me closer together with my like closest friends. I want to just try and build something. I didn't know exactly what at that point in time, but I had some ideas. But like, that was the genesis of the idea, and behind Picnic, I mean. And basically, the first 4 years of trying to build stuff in that space, everything we built was multiplayer. So what I mean by that is you had to have friends on the app for the product to give you any value whatsoever. And we tried, I don't even know how many iterations, we pivoted so many times, we've raised lots of money across several different rounds, just convincing different people this is worth backing. And over all of that time, basically just really struggled to overcome the cold start problem of, this app has no use whatsoever unless my friends are on here. And so a year ago, we decided to pivot away from doing multiplayer apps and said, well, what if we started with a single player app, which still can be over time made multiplayer, where my friends are actually on the experience with me. But what is there a way that we could actually start off with a single player app where when I download it, I don't need my friends here. It still helps me socially in some way. It still helps me be better friends with people I care about, but doesn't have the real complexity of trying to convince all my friends to use this app to get any value from it. And that's kind of what led us to doing an app that is cleaning up your camera roll, because it was effectively us admitting defeat on trying to build the next Instagram out of the gate, and us trying to move towards something much more realistic that we feel still actually has a really high probability of actually becoming a social platform at some point, but starting with a real problem that you can solve just by yourself. And the reason why it's still, for me, is actually a good thing, like a product that is worth working on, is because what is in your camera roll is basically your most precious memories of you and your friends, or if you're older and you've got kids, maybe then it's you and your children or pets or whatever it might be. But basically, the most important people in your life are in your camera roll, and the most important thing on your phone, like if you lose your phone, what's the thing you are actually worried about losing? It's not anything other than your photos. That's the one thing that people are actually annoyed about if they lost their phone. So there's a lot of value in your camera roll. And the insight that led us to start working on this was just, we take so many pictures, we take probably thousands of pictures and videos every year, and we don't really have a plan for what to do with them. We just kind of just dump them into our camera rolls. They gather dust in cloud storage somewhere, and we rarely look back on them. But each photo and video in your camera roll is like a potential springboard for a connection of some kind with someone. Because often when we do go into our camera rolls and we stumble upon old interesting memories, the first thing we want to do is share it with the person who was in that photo, or, you know, share it on social media with someone, because actually, yeah, it's your camera roll is full of stories, basically. And at the moment, the camera roll is more of a storage unit, like a storage tool. And what we want to create with Picnic is more of a storytelling tool. So you go on there and actually your camera roll is useful. It's not just full of clutter and impossible to find the things you're looking for, but instead it's just this really nicely organized storytelling tool full of all of my best memories, all my best moments that I can easily share with my friends. That's the premise of Picnic now. And although it's not the original vision of building a, you know, Instagram 2.0 or whatever, it still has the potential to create a lot of really positive connections with people. People remembering really nice stories and having conversations about them is social connection. So yeah, we're still working on the same mission, but we're just going about it in quite a different way now. And the long-term vision for this product still is to make it multiplayer eventually anyway, at which point we're back being a social app again. But interesting thought-provoking thing would be, does a social app have to be social for it to actually be good for your social health? And that's kind of what we're, I guess, our hypothesis is it doesn't. In fact, probably the most effective way to build a tool to help people's social health is to not actually start with the need for you to have friends on the app. Like Picnic, you have no friends on the app, but because our users actually use it every day and they send memories to their friends and they have conversations about these memories, that is a more effective way to improve social health than building a social app that has friends on it, but no one uses it because it's crap. And that's basically what most consumer social founders end up spending 5 years doing, like me. So you build a multiplayer app that no one uses and doesn't go anywhere, so you've made zero impact on anyone's social health, versus building a single player app that actually gets you connecting with your friends in some way. That's actually a more impactful use of my time than this. And that's kind of why I don't mind the fact that this isn't a social app anymore, because it's still having a bigger impact on people's social health than doing what I was doing before.
And so then what are you tracking in terms of the core user actions? Is it then sharing a photo outside of the app?
Sharing photos outside of the app. But I mean, ultimately, even just knowing that you having a more organized camera roll, like getting rid of the clutter, making actual memories out of your holiday photos or whatever the photos are important to you, even knowing that that actually means the next time you're in the pub with a friend and you go to tell that story from your trip to Ibiza in 2014, instead of scrolling for 5 minutes whilst your friend awkwardly sits there going, fuck's sake, like this is not worth scrolling to, or at least like it's not worth 2 minutes of my time watching you scroll after this. If that actually got reduced down to opening a camera roll and just immediately finding the pictures, that's already making you, it's a better storytelling tool than just a cluttered camera roll full of crap. So yeah, the proof, I guess, for us really is in the reviews we get from our users and the joy that people get out of using Picnic. And I know even that is enough for me as a consumer founder to be like really happy building this, because is it like curing cancer? No. But is it doing something that genuinely brings people a lot of joy and helps them to tell stories and share memories with friends in a really, really good way? Yes. So that's an amazing thing for me to build. For me personally, that's enough. Like, it doesn't have, maybe over the years I've gone from super, super ambitious, needs to be like the next TikTok, to actually, I don't need to be the next TikTok. I can just build something that makes some people really happy, and that will be great. And also hopefully enough money to survive. But that's kind of it now.
What prompted that shift in drive?
Probably also like one aspect being just the fact that the probability of actually succeeding, if you're just chasing this, I mean, in any VC-backed business, you're going to be taking a lot of risk and it's very unlikely you're going to succeed. But in consumer social, I think it's probably the riskiest category that is possible to build in. So if you're trying to build the next TikTok, it is just an absolutely like insane amount of risk you're taking. And it's so unlikely You know, even like a lot of the consumer social founders, the founder of Instagram launched a new social app recently and it's flopped. The founder of Zenly, which was acquired by Snapchat, has launched another one, seems to be flopping a bit. I mean, all of them are flopping, and that's not to throw them under the bus, so I should probably cut that out. But basically, a lot of very experienced consumer social founders have built one thing, had managed to catch lightning in a bottle, and then they've tried to do it again afterwards, and it's not gone well at all. Even though they've got all of this amazing wisdom, it's incredibly, incredibly hard to do twice. And so, yeah, in general, like, I think after doing it for 3 or 4 years and failing at it, that is what led to the shift, because I was like, you have to sometimes just front up to like reality, even if I deluded myself for 4 years that I was good enough to do that. And maybe I am good enough, but I just didn't do the right things. Or maybe I'm, you know, there's all sorts of reasons why we weren't successful for those 4 years. But ultimately we got to a point where I've been trying for so long at something that is so, so hard. And it feels like there's no real shame in failing at that. But this other path presented itself partly through lots of the insights we've learned over those years failing at this and really understanding like consumer behaviors around photos, photo sharing, because we were spending so much time with Gen Z and all of these topics, we started to see an actual problem they had that needed solving. And the amazing thing about moving from this, you need to build the next TikTok, to now you're just building an app to help people clean up their camera roll, is people actually really love this. We have users, they pay for it. Like, it's so energizing just waking up and having people leave a 5-star review that is like, this is the best app I've ever used, blah, 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 whatever. And you just don't get that when you're going after this, because everyone's like, your app is crap all the time. So a lot of it is just honestly probably mental endurance. You can't just fail continually for 10 years unless you're, maybe I'm just not a good enough founder, but like, I think 4 years failing in a row at the same thing is already a long time to fail horrifically at something. So it was like, I just need a win. I need some success again. And this was working. And it is working still, and it's exciting. And so, yeah, once you kind of make that shift in your mind of like, oh, I don't need to build this crazy ambitious thing anymore, I'm happy with this now, then you start to almost rewire your brain of like, why am I happy with this? And then you just create a new narrative of why you're happy with this, which I've now done. And now I'm really, really happy with it. Whereas when I was doing this, I've got all these narratives of like, why do I need to do this? Well, I've got VC backing. I need to make a $1 billion company. I need to be really rich. I need to do all these things. And actually, over time, I'm like, now rewriting all of those narratives, and I don't need any of those things. And actually, this is what I care about. And I'm not just backwards rationalizing, because that's where we are. I do genuinely feel really, really happy now with where we're at.
What is the narrative for this point in time?
Well, as I said, one part being actually solving a problem for someone is better than solving a problem for no one. And that was what was going on. But the other reality is it's a problem that I have myself. So I really like waking up and working on a feature and then going, I can't wait for this to be in the app so that I can use it. That's really, really fun as well. It's also got a much, much higher chance of financial returns because it's making revenue. It's growing really well. It's solving a problem. We think we're one of the best in the market, if not the best in the market at what it does. So we've got this kind of opportunity to actually build a market leading product of some kind, which if you build a market leading product of some kind, you're probably going to create some financial value. So that's exciting. That gets me motivated. Especially after going down the entrepreneurial path, in part because you're like, I want to make a massive company so that I can be really, really rich. Not the only reason, but one of the reasons. So yeah, after doing 4 years of getting nowhere near big with the other stuff, it's very comforting being like, oh, here's an idea that actually could make some money.
So interesting. So when I chat to Hats, when I asked him, where did he think you two were different? Mm. He said that he feels a lot more satisfied with building a smaller, profitable company at slower growth. And he said that your ambition is generally like go big or go home.
Used to be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of shifted more to this like very happy.
Yeah.
Although fewer people, deeper problem, as opposed to less people, thinner problem, maybe.
Well, I'm not sure it's like about the depth of the problem or anything. It's more just, so my ambition is still big for Picnic. It's just that it could still be an absolutely huge company. It's just that the scale of company that I was going for before was truly like, I mean, Facebook is like a $1 trillion company. Like that's the kind of scale of company that I had in my mind of building. And now I've realized I'm definitely too shit and also don't really want to sign up to that journey anymore. I did when I raised the money, and I did when I started Picnic. I think maybe I got kind of swept up in some of my previous experiences working at like Bumble with some amazing founders and them being like billionaires and me being like, cool, yeah, I want to be like you one day. But over time, realizing that the cost of doing that to your health, to your enjoyment of life, your satisfaction is extremely high. Your probability of doing it is extremely low. And like this other route is so much more like balanced in your favor, making an actually profitable, good company that could grow really big, but doesn't have to right now. That is a much, 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 much more sensible way to build a business. And so effectively, Harry was right and I was wrong. That's the key takeaway. It just took me a while to let go of that, you know, that concept of needing to build something enormous. But I still, for example, have ambition that Picnic becomes a household name. For me, there's like three boxes I want to tick almost as to a role I would do. One is this helping people in some way that feels social in some way? Like, is this helping people connect with their friends in some way? I don't ever see myself really working on products in consumer that don't have some social element to them. So that's like a big, big thing that I just really enjoy and is important for me. I.e. the doing good in the world that I personally relate to a lot is just like the social connections part of life. So that's important. The next thing that's important is, can this be like a really, really big consumer business? Like, I don't want to build something so niche that like it's not going to have a big impact. If it gets to the maximum potential of the company, is it going to have a big impact or not? And if it can only get to like, I don't know, not numbers, but you know, if it can't really impact that many people's lives and it's only impacting them, the people who it does impact in quite a minor way, that's not particularly exciting to me. And then the third thing is, can it actually make a financial return of some kind? And I think Picnic is actually ticking all of those boxes now. Whereas in the first iterations, it probably wasn't ticking the third box because I thought it could make a financial return if I could do it, but obviously I couldn't do it. So sometimes you just gotta admit defeat.
What does your measure of scale look like still?
For how big Picnic can be?
Yeah, what is a lot of people?
Well, every smartphone owner in the world takes pictures, almost. Like, and there are how many billion people on the planet and how many billion smartphone owners? So what I want to build with Picnic is basically a companion app for everyone to have to make sense of their photos, to make memories from the photos and videos that they take. And at the moment we do, you know, quite a simple product to help you do that, get rid of the clutter, organize the photos you've taken. But the scale is of how big it can be is enormous in my view, because basically this problem isn't going away. We only are going to take more and more pictures. And actually, 5 years ago, even I had less of a problem with this because I'd lived for five less years, taken five years less of photos. But even in the last 5 years, I've noticed how much more clutter and how much further up my camera roll I have to scroll to find things. And this is also right now just based on what we take with our phones. But like, there's been a lot of hype around the Meta glasses. Who knows whether the glasses is the right form factor, but if there is a future form factor where we're taking videos and pictures all the time, all day long, then some tool is going to be needed to make sense of all the photos and videos we're taking, to basically craft and sort of cut down all of this raw footage, as I'm sure you can appreciate as a podcast host, all of this raw footage down into the essence of what your life has amounted to. Like, what is the meaning of your life? I think at the moment, the camera roll does not allow me to have any real sense of what I've done. If I open it, I can scroll for 5 minutes and I can get like a blurry view of roughly what I've done. But it doesn't give me the answer to, like, what cool shit have I done or what has been the meaning of my life. And I think that Picnic's potential opportunity is to be the eventual answer to that question. It's like, what have I done with my life? We help you craft the answer to that question and then be the source of truth for that question in your phone or in whatever device you're using. So I think the scale of that problem is massive because, like, even just on a personal level, I want to be able to look back when I'm 40, 50, 60, 70 and be able to answer questions really accurately and with nice curated answers to questions to my kids or to my grandkids. Like, what did you do, Daddy, when you were 25? I can now show you. Whereas right now, if someone says to me, what did I do when I was 23? I have absolutely no idea how to answer that question. I don't even know where it is in my camera roll. And so I would have to just freestyle and then I'd have to spend, you know, minutes or hours researching what I did in that year. Whereas my vision for the future is that everyone just knows what they've done with their life. They're a lot more in touch with who they are as a person through doing this as well, because they've got a really good storyline of what they've done in the past, which also helps them be the person they want to be in the future as well. And all of this stuff has a lot of, like, second and third order benefits to actually having an app that helps you organize your memories. But right now, it just helps you clean up the crap from your camera roll. So the scale of the ambition to what we're doing now is obviously a big chasm. But that's also, for me, exciting because it means even if we just were the best app in the world at cleaning up clutter, we could probably be really successful at that and grow really big. But if we can expand our vision and what we do as a product as we go along these stages, like, the deeper we go into the vision, the more exciting the impact of the company can be. But even just this for now is fun and exciting and could be a good, but it feels like a good use of my time still. So that's why I'm really excited to keep working on it.
And you just closed some money.
And we've just closed a little bit of money. So that's good.
Well done.
What's this now? 1, 2, 3, 4. Four, like, pre-seed, seed, plus seed, whatever's we've done now, just for the same ideas.
Have they all been roughly the same amount of money?
No. We raised 550K in our friends and family round. We raised 2.1 million in our seed round. Then we did a seed extension of 400K. And then this is a seed, well,
squared.
I don't even know. It doesn't need a title, but
it's some money in the bank.
Some money in the bank. So this is 500K, which we hope will take us to profitability. And yeah, now that we have a business that makes revenue and is actually can reach profitability, like, we hopefully will never have to raise more money again.
How many users do you have?
So we've had helped about 100,000 people clean up their camera roll. We have about 40,000 active users and we're doing about 22,000 MRR at the moment.
Hold on. What do you count as an active user?
Monthly active. Monthly active. So they have to, like, clean up their camera roll a bit, at least once a month.
And there's the premium paid feature, which gives you what exactly?
So the Mechanics is a freemium app. So we give you a certain number of swipes every day. A swipe is basically reviewing a photo. Like, do I want to keep this? Do I want to get rid of it? Do I want to put it in an album? Do I want to favorite it? Whatever. Each time you do that, you use one swipe. And once you've run out of swipes, you can come back tomorrow and do it again. Obviously, that mechanic is actually, there's two reasons why we do it that way. One is obviously we need to constrain something in the product so that people will pay for it. So the paid version gives you unlimited swipes. But also, we don't want to build an app that you spend 2 hours a day on. We don't want to become another ad-based product where we want you to spend all day in there watching ads. So we don't have ads in our app. We're not going to put ads in there because we're trying to build something that is just like a nice 5-minute break from TikTok or break from your day to go back and reminisce a little bit, send a memory to a friend, whatever it might be, and then get on with your day. So there's like a nice side to our monetization that, yes, people moan, like, we want more free swipes, but then actually a lot of people in our reviews say stuff like, I actually like that there's a swipe limit because it gets me to just do it and then stop and then get on with my day again. So yeah, that's the main benefit to the premium is that you can get unlimited swipes, but also you can sort things into albums on the paid plan. There's other, like, handy Basically, it helps you clean up your camera roll quicker if you pay for the... That's the main actual benefit you're getting. So you can either do it slowly over a long period of time, but if you're someone who just wants to turbo through the whole thing and have the cleanest, most organized camera roll of your life, like now, then pay for the premium and you can get that done pretty quickly.
Well done, mate. You've hung on for 5 years.
Yes, it felt very much like hanging on for a lot of it.
And that, I think, is the thing that so many founders don't give themselves much credit for. It's like the purpose. Your job is to keep the company alive.
Mm-hmm.
And you've definitely kept the company alive.
Just about.
Going back to previous companies, you've worked at some crazy places. So Happn, they're at 100 million users or more than that.
Something
probably.
Like that. Yeah.
You then were at Fever. How big were Fever?
I don't even know their user numbers. All I know is they reached unicorn status like a year ago or something. And they're big. But I don't know the numbers. Millions of users.
And then you were at Grabble, and Grabble had like a spike, and then
Grabble had a spike died. When I joined the team. I spent all their money on ads, giving them users that didn't retain, and then the company failed. So it's my fault that it failed. But no, it's not actually my fault. It's Dan's fault. Always Dan's fault. But no. Grabble. We grew quite a lot. I mean, I was basically paid to come in and grow the app, and that's what I did. But it was kind of in an era where it was growth at all costs, and also don't worry about the business model. Don't worry about, is this a good use of our money? Let's just make the chart go up and to the right. And I was good at doing that. So that's what I did. But it was not the right thing for the business to do that. And I was young enough and stupid enough to... Well, sorry, better way of saying it is I wasn't experienced enough to make better decisions, or at least push back and say, we shouldn't do this, we should do this. I was just like, my job is to do this, and that's what I'm being told. So that's what we're going to do. Grabble, unfortunately, wasn't a success, but it did lead to Heights, which is... great company, and I'm a big fan. Got my magnesium the other day.
And then you bought Chappie, and then Chappie invested in by Whitney Wolf, and then got bought by Bumble's acquirers. Is that right?
Yeah, so Chappie was incubated by Bumble and the group behind Bumble, and then the whole group got acquired. I don't know what year it was now, but I should probably know more of these key dates in my life. Like I'm always like, they're like, what year is that?
And if
I'm
only
like,
you had pictures of them and you could just...
Yeah,
quickly...
well, exactly. I haven't got to that part of my camera yet. I'm only 33% of the way through. Well, it was acquired by Blackstone for $3 billion. Chappie was obviously not acquired for $3 billion, just to be clear. But it was part of that acquisition. So
a big part, obviously.
Very, very big part. I think it would have been worth maybe $1.5 billion without Chappie, but whatever. Probably more like 2.99, but fact, no, even that's generous, 2.999.
What did you take away from working inside these like very classic startups you have Happn, which is like obviously huge, same with Fever, and then Grabble huge and died, and then Chappie getting acquired.
Different lessons in each one. Like the main value almost of each of those experiences, because they were all mobile apps that were very kind of, they were consumer mobile apps. So there wasn't actually that much variance in, there wasn't an insane amount of learnings to be had. Whether I'm growing a consumer app that sells fashion or things to do in London or dating, weirdly, there's not actually that much variance in what my job is. The real lessons came from the people I worked with and the people I worked under. Each of those companies had really, really, really interesting founders, really impressive, like, smart founders, and each of them had incredibly different management styles. So for me, it was more of a exploration of what are the different ways of running a company? What are the different ways of creating a culture? What are the different ways of leading teams? And it wasn't intentional that it wasn't intentionally done that way, but I just, when I look back on that period, they just could not have been any more different. Like,
can you speak to the differences?
Happn, for example, was very, very old school French style of management. So it was, This is, I don't know what I'm about to say. Probably shouldn't be in there, but
we can cut that off.
We can see. So, I mean, there was, when I was there, the period I was there, there was quite a fear-based culture. It was very old school in the sense that you're in the morning. If you're late, you're shouted at. And then it's like gather everyone around the computer. Everyone gathered around in like the main area. And we would basically like go through each department's like numbers. And if you haven't hit your numbers, like, why haven't you hit your numbers? That kind of dynamic. And just a lot of pressure, a lot of stress. And it created really good results, but it didn't create the best culture, I don't think. But it did create urgency. It did. The interesting thing about each of these experiences was there were pros and cons to each of these management styles. And, you know, it's not about throwing any of them under the bus because they were bad or good, but it's more just I took away learnings about like, oh, well, if you manage people in that way, then what you create is a dynamic like this. And do I want that dynamic in a company that I'm going to build in the future? Maybe, maybe not. Or is there a way I can harness the positive side of that culture? Like, for example, the French old school way of doing things. I think it's actually a lot of pros to what they did. There's real structure. There's real like cadence and kind of habits that are formed, like a real sort of the cadence thing, I think, is really the most interesting. Like you come in every day and it's about what have we done yesterday? Like the Elon Musk quote of like wherever he tweeted to the CEO of Twitter at the time where he was like, what have you shipped this week or whatever? Like that's the vibe. But that actually is incredibly good for high performance cultures, I think, is to have a sense of urgency and to have an expectation that I do something today. I'm going to have to. So every day it happened, we used to have to report, what did we do today? At the end of the day, we'd have to send the CEO the email of what did we do today? And then tomorrow morning when we come in and we go through the numbers, it's like, why aren't your numbers good? So yes, it was a very high stress. And yes, there was lots of downsides to it too. But actually that cadence of like, when I come in today, I need to actually perform. I need to actually deliver something. That's actually something that I really like and I try to do bring to Picnic, but I think there's ways of bringing that which don't cost people their mental health as much or that don't make people feel like shit. And that unfortunately was one of the downsides of the way it happened, did it at the time, was people were getting publicly humiliated, people were getting shouted at, and that was really unpleasant, and to the point where that is obviously clearly something that I take away from that. Like, I don't want to ever be the leader of a company doing that stuff, because that's just extremely unpleasant to be on the receiving end of. So I don't want to ever be doing that to someone else.
And so then you've taken this urgency in terms of what are we shipping this week, but we don't have the accountability is different. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I think one way I would say it is. And this is a shift that actually it took me a long time to properly process and properly implement a Picnic even, is I used to be a lot on the mindset of urgency, cadence. But then I would start to create a bit of a dynamic that's adversarial, where you're like, it's me as the founder, I'm being pushy. So you guys are trying to, like, you guys are, it's you against me. And I'm trying to like force you to be doing these things that I'm saying we need to be done. And I think over time, what I've tried to do is not be adversarial at all and actually be coming from a point of view of completely collaborative. Like, we are both working towards this goal. This is the cadence we need to achieve. So what can we do to like achieve that cadence? Like, what would you do? Like, you know, much more of a coaching style, like partnership with the people I'm working with now. Whereas before I would build narratives in my head of like, this is what we need to do today. So if you haven't done that, then that means you're not doing it for some reason, you know, you're not trying hard enough, or you kind of make up narratives of why that person's not doing the thing that you want them to do. Whereas when you come at it from a more collaborative viewpoint, you find out, oh, no, they have actually done loads of work. It's just that they were missing this piece of information, or, you know, whatever it might be. So I think to some, the main way that I've tried to take forward the happen stuff in a positive way is actually just to soften it from an adversarial relationship to a fully collaborative like our goal is to make to reach this cadence. My goal as CEO is for you to reach this cadence. But that's very different from our goal is to reach this cadence. Are you okay with that? Do you agree with that goal? Cool. How can we achieve that goal? Like, that's the big difference in my mind.
Sounds like it's a case of getting buy-in when setting goals, but then what other areas?
Not just when setting the goals, though. Even when talking about the goals. Like, there's a big difference between the way I used to do things, which would be, oh, this hasn't been done. Narrative in my head. This person must be lazy. This person must not want to succeed as much as I do, or must not want Picnic to succeed as much as I do, or this person must be bad at their job. And so I'm then coming into the discussion with all of these negative possible assumptions, and I'm actually more focused on getting you to just deliver this than I am understanding why and understanding what can we do differently. And also, there's another element to it, which is it depends on who you hire as well as to how easy it is to come into these conversations as a collaborative person. Because in the past where I've worked with people where I felt like, oh, that was a bad hire, then I go into those conversations. Even now I find that hard to go in collaborative because I'm like, I don't really know if you are actually trying hard enough or if you are actually good enough. So there's also an element of trust is built also based on respecting the person and really believing that person is fundamentally believing that that person is trying their best at all times, is good enough to do the job. And if you're missing that, that's something that I think I've learned over the years is if I'm missing that personally, I really struggle then to be really collaborative with them. Even though that's just more of a reflection of me being a bad leader, it makes it a lot easier for you as a leader if you're working with people who you just intrinsically trust fully, are always working really hard and are actually capable of doing the job, which again, some of the other jobs I worked in didn't always have that dynamic because I didn't actually work with people always who I did fully trust or respect or believe that they could do the job, which I don't know what that says about me, but.
Is there a way that you screen for high integrity, trustworthy people?
I mean, the truth is, honestly, like we've tried things in the past where we've had like different questions to try and get at some of that stuff. I personally don't find those that useful because I think people can make shit up. People say what they want. They think you want to hear often. I think it's more in the softer interactions between them starting the process and getting to the point where you're offering them a job or even after that. You can figure out a lot about someone's integrity in those interactions that they are not. So I personally don't find asking people direct questions of like, tell me a time when you've shown integrity. Don't genuinely find those as useful as just looking out for in every interaction, integrity, in every interaction, collaboration, and the kinds of traits that you want to see in your team members, because you'll see even small things you can pick up on and be like, hmm. And then if you find I find something in the interview process where I'm like, oh, didn't like that interaction, then I can dig into it somehow, or I can try another interaction of some kind in a future point and see if I get the same reaction or if I get same resistance, or, you know, and then I can kind of dig into that a bit. So I find that is a more useful way of finding out whether I'm going to get on with someone and whether I actually trust them or think they're high integrity. Like an example would be when you get to negotiations about salary. I think the way people handle that for me is really, really demonstrative of how they're going to behave in every difficult conversation during the process of working with someone later. Because if people approach it from a collaborative point of view where they're like, here's where I'm at, here are my needs, but I also understand, or I want to understand, what are your needs as a company and as a hirer? And if they're coming into it with a very collaborative, open mind, and they're not trying to like bulldoze you or railroad you or make or gaslight you or make you feel in any way that you're on the other side of the table as an adversary, but instead we're in this together, we both want to work together clearly, let's find a way to make this work. Because it's interesting because, you know, how many interactions do you have in the interview process which are just them trying to get the job? But the one interaction in the interview process that they actually, the real them has to come out is the negotiation on how much are they going to get paid. because all the other stuff, it can be theater, it can be, you know, like, I'm just saying what you want to hear. But the one thing that at least, you know, I mean, there's obviously the side of it where people don't negotiate well enough for themselves. But actually, if you're a high integrity leader, then you will still pay them the right amount anyway, right? You're not going to like bulldoze them in the other way, in the direction. But the one thing that candidates who have low integrity do show up in their real self, in their real form for is the negotiation on salary. Because they might be perfect in the rest of the interview, salary negotiation, suddenly they turn into a bit of a prick. You're like, interesting. Like, that's the first time we've had a real, honest, authentic interaction then. Mm. And I didn't like how that went. And obviously it depends on, that might not rule them out of the job entirely, but that's certainly a red flag at that point. If they've behaved poorly in that negotiation, then that's kind of going to show you how they're going to behave in tough moments in the job.
Mm. We went off on a tangent.
We did.
Chappie. Mm. Incubation within Bumble.
Yeah.
Working alongside Whitney Wolf. And then your co-founder, Ollie, who was on Made in Chelsea at the same time.
Yeah.
Quite a group to be around.
Quite a motley crew.
Yeah. What did you take away from that experience? Either seeing Bumble from sort of an insider's perspective or just building Chappie.
The main takeaway from working within the Bumble kind of organization and kind of like flying over to Austin and spending time in Bumble's office with the Bumble team and like going to Coachella with the Bumble team when they did the big Coachella activations and things like that. Basically got to spend a lot of time with the team, and this was the very early team, and just the one very clear learning that I hadn't really had in any of the roles before that was the power of brand, both externally and internally for a company. And the one thing that Bumble did unbelievably well was just this incredibly consistent and incredibly impactful brand that just percolated through the entire organization, from Whitney down to every nook and cranny of the company, was just like stuffed full of this amazing Bumble brand. And that really shapes the behavior of the employees, that shapes like the pride in the company, that shapes the, obviously the success of the company externally as well. Like, people obviously finding the brand interesting and wanting to download the app and be part of that movement, but specifically the internal stuff as well. Like, obviously there's a danger to building brands that can become a bit of a cult. And I don't know if, you know, I don't want to say Bumble was or wasn't a cult, but like, but the brand, the strength of that brand was unreal. Like, it was incredibly inspiring and impressive. And something that all of the other jobs I'd worked in was very much a barely even like thought about thing, weirdly. A lot of the companies before that were very big on like smart growth hacks to grow your business and building apps that millions of people use, but they all had terrible brands, pretty much.
Are we linking brand to culture here?
I think so, yeah. I think that actually really is important. And to be completely honest, the culture at the other places versus the culture at Bumble was much, much better at Bumble, much, much worse than all the other places. Not to throw him under the bus, but...
What's an example of like amazing Bumble culture that you hadn't seen anywhere else?
And again, I would caveat this with like, every company has pros and cons, and also as Bumble grew, things changed and blah, blah, blah. So I'm talking specifically about like an era of Bumble, which I was involved in.
What era was it? What are the dates? What years?
You're asking me the same issue. 2016 to 18, maybe?
Yeah, that was when you co-founded Chappie, 16 to 18.
Okay, there you go. So, yeah. And also to be clear, I wasn't involved in Bumble. Like, I was just in the building and I was getting to like learn through osmosis, but I wasn't in any way to be credited for anything Bumble did, but I got to learn a lot from what they were doing. So the examples would just be like every detail that you can think of, Whitney had covered. So for example, every laptop that is issued to a Bumble employee, this is back then, maybe it's not this way anymore, but every laptop has a little sticker that you put on your laptop, and it had Bumble's values here. So as you're typing every day, you open your laptop here, when next to your mouse pad is Bumble's values, like be kind, whatever. I can't remember all of them. I can even remember one of them. That's how, if I can remember one of Bumble's brand values and I didn't even work there, that to me is a sign that it's had an impact on me because I've actually remembered some of the values. But anyway, they had the values there to remind every employee in every interaction, if they're sending an email, next to your hand has be kind, has whatever those things are. And the impact of that, to me at least, is huge because you don't have any excuse to why later on when you're now speaking to your manager or trying to explain why you've behaved in a certain way, if it wasn't on brand, if it wasn't within your company's culture, Whitney's got a pretty good stick to beat you with. You know, that's, I don't want to throw Whitney under the bus, but but the leader,
regular meetings or just like a semi?
No, but you then as a leader have a really good compelling case to say, well, why didn't you behave in those ways? Because it's clearly here, it's written here, it's shown to you here. So effectively, and I think this is a very common bit of wisdom that's said a lot by startup founders much more successful than me, but it's culture is ultimately just having a very clear message and a very clear set of values that you want to impart on your team and remind them of. And then it's literally a question of how many times can I beat this drum? Like, I'm just beating this drum constantly to make sure that every single person is clear on these values constantly. You can't just do it once, make this sticker on the laptop, give it to them, and then just never talk about it again. It has to be a constant drumbeat of these are our values. And every action has to ladder up to those values, both your actions as the leaders, but also the actions you take as a company, actions you take as a product, actions you take in your marketing, actions you take internally as employees. And effectively what Bumble did so well was make that the engine for growth. In every other app that I worked on, the engine for growth was smart performance marketing and smart technical sort of growth marketing. Bumble didn't spend a penny on performance marketing until like year four or something of their existence. Everything was grown organically through brand. And obviously they spent lots of money on brand, but they did it all through brand. And the brand was so consistent throughout that company that was just incredibly, like, A, an amazing experience to just be witness and be part of in some way. But B, it just taught me so much about the importance of brand, where before that I had a mindset of, if you can't measure it, it's not interesting, or I'd much prefer things you can measure, and I much prefer my world of like growth marketing. But actually brand is incredibly important, and I'm really like grateful that I had that experience, because I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't seen it almost. I would have been like, yeah, brand, is brand really that important? You know, is culture that important? But like, obviously I would have had to learn that the hard way, whereas I got to see firsthand the value of it from someone who, not just someone, but a team who was so incredible at it. Because it wasn't just Whitney who was amazing at brand. The whole early Bumble team were really, really amazing at brand.
So how strong do you think the Picnic brand is?
Well, I think it's pretty good, to be honest. I don't think it's anywhere near as good as it could be, because we haven't honestly spent as much time as we probably should on it. But
how much time should you spend on that?
That's a good question. I think where we're at as a business, I've been personally very focused in the last like months on fundraising. So that's taken up loads of my time. And we only pivoted to this idea in a year ago. And so I think there's an element of validating that your concept is worth putting loads of time and energy into the brand. But even like that being said, if I had not spent loads of time on the brand, I don't think it's giving a fair shot to any idea you're testing in consumer to not at least put the time in at the beginning to make a good brand. So I think our brand right now is good. We were really lucky to have an amazing designer, and the copy we've come to with in terms of messaging, I'm really kind of quite happy with. Like, this whole sort your life out messaging is a quite unique position in the world, and it's one that resonates with a lot of people, because everyone always feels like, I need to sort my life out. Like, people say it, but then they don't do anything about it. Picnic is an app that can help you feel like you're doing something about sorting your life out. So I'm really happy with lots of it, but now there's another level to take it to. But as a minimum, to test an idea, you should have messaging and a brand that you're proud of to some degree, because otherwise that's one of your tools in your toolkit that you're just not using, and therefore is it a good enough test of that idea if you've got a crappy brand?
That makes complete sense. We're coming to the end, so I've got one more question on startup experience, and then I've got one deep question about you outside of startups. Chappie, a dating app for gay men.
Mm-hmm.
You're a straight man.
Tell me about it.
as far as I'm aware.
Yep.
You haven't made
still,
a pass
still straight,
me.
Still straight, yeah. A lot of people still convinced I'm not straight, but I am still straight, as things stand.
It feels like there's been a shift with you in terms of building a company because there's a big opportunity versus building a company because you feel the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there's a balance of the two. Chappie, you're like completely disconnected from the problem specifically. Obviously you are dating and you're connected with the dating problem, but not the gay dating problem. Whereas Picnic, you said this is actually scratching one of your own itches.
Mm-hmm.
How big of an impact do you think that's made in the company building process?
Well, first of all, I don't actually personally prescribe to the notion that you have to be, it has to be a pain point that you personally deal with. I think it helps a lot and it's probably really, really great if that is true. But my experience with Chappie, for example, although I went into Chappie without tons of experience of gay world because I'm not gay, it quickly became a problem that I became really attached to and became really engrossed in and involved in and like wanted to go deeper into, even though it wasn't something that I then went home at night and kind of it affected me personally. But I did care about solving it a lot. And you can kind of learn to love a problem and you can learn to love or be passionate about any problem, I personally believe, because I definitely felt in the midst of Chappie, I felt like I was, you know, about as passionate as, more passionate than most gay guys were about the problem, because obviously I'm like so in it. So first point, just to kind of challenge the notion that you can't be passionate about something that's not your own problem. But to answer your question, how helpful has that been now actually working on something that is my problem? I'd say there's pros and cons to it, honestly, because the cons would be I'm too close to the problem and I have too much of a view on what I think the solution should be. And then you have to really be very careful to not bring your bias into decisions, especially around the product and things like that. Because I'd be like, oh, but I want it to be like that. And going back to what I said earlier around putting myself in other people's shoes, when I was doing Chappie, I had to put myself in everyone else's shoes all the time because I'm not in my own shoes at that point. Even if I'm in my own shoes, it's not helpful to the conversation. So by default, I have to be trying to be everyone, put myself in everyone else's shoes. With Picnic, I'm like, I want the app to be this way because that's how I want it to be. So I have to actively take myself out of my own shoes and remind myself to keep doing that. So that's actually a bit of a con in some ways to doing it. But it's a small con overall because I think the pros are when the going gets tough, like it, if you really care about solving the problem, then you can find like another gear. Like I'm not sure, for example, it would be an interesting A/B test if it could ever be run of would I have stuck at Chappie for 5 years if I hadn't had it, or 4 years, if I hadn't had any success at all in the first 4 years. Whereas Chappie was an immediate success, the product worked out the gate and it was doing well. So don't know whether I would have had the stamina to keep going into year four, whereas I have had the stamina to keep going into year four of failing at Picnic. So that's definitely one thing that feels true and has probably saved the company in some ways, because obviously if I hadn't carried on going, we wouldn't be sat here talking about Picnic. I would have folded it probably a year or 2 years ago and we wouldn't have had that breakthrough in year five because we wouldn't have got there. So there's definitely got to be some element of that. Beyond that, I mean, the flip side to the I said earlier, the downside is that I am too opinionated about what I want from the product. But the flip side is obviously I also can be really creative with the company because I'm coming up with things that I would want and they feel a lot more personal now. And so my suggestions and ideas and things are much more like rooted in logic sometimes because I'm like, well, I would want that. Whereas maybe with Chappie, I'd have some absolutely dog shit ideas because I'd be like, is that a good idea? And I have no idea. And then everyone would be like, no, that's a terrible idea. I'm like, okay. But in terms of like company building, there was obviously a lot more to it than just the product. I'm trying to think if there's any like company building things that have changed about it. I mean, maybe there's an element as well of like, well, in fact, there definitely is an element. One thing that I had at Chappie, specifically because I wasn't a gay guy, was a lot of hesitation or sort of skepticism about like my motivations behind doing the company and whether I was being authentic in that role. And you know, if I had to pitch VCs and I was a straight guy, I'm sure I would have had a lot of eyebrows raised slash probably red marks put against my name saying not great founder fit for this product. Whereas Picnic Now, I assume most investors give me a green tick at least to say good founder fit, founder problem fit. Which if you're fund, if you're a company that needs to fundraise, that's pretty important. So yeah.
I feel like you have like some very beautifully evolved characteristics, like founder characteristics. It seems like the past 10 years have, you definitely feel like a very different founder from how you describe yourself 10 years ago.
No, yeah, for sure. I feel like it's a craft and I feel like I'm still at the beginning, but maybe I'm getting towards the end of like the first chapter, or I don't know, but I feel like I've actually made progress in that, in my ability to be a founder, or my craft of being a founder. And also there's a million ways to be a founder. I've crafted my own way of being a founder. And to be honest, it's not for probably anyone. If I actually sat down and went through my blueprint of how I am a founder, most people who are founders would be like, that is a shocking way to be a founder. But for me, it works. It makes me happy.
Like, which of your characteristics do you think they'd have that response to?
I think I'm just like, I'm very much a person who believes in, I don't believe in just like hustle culture at all. And I know that that's kind of going out of vogue now anyway, but more like I treat an hour walking around a park by myself in the middle of a work day as important as sitting at my desk doing actual work. And I will regularly do like days where maybe only two or three of my hours are actually at my desk doing work. And it doesn't mean I'm not making progress on the company. It doesn't mean I'm not adding value to the business. It doesn't mean I'm not having ideas. It doesn't mean I'm not doing things of value to the business. If my mind is being focused on Picnic, that is the important thing. And in order to achieve me focusing my mind on a business, I need to be able to put it in the best possible conditions to do that. So if I need to take a nap in the middle of the day, I'll take a nap. If I want to play paddle in the middle of the day, I will do that. Because if it means that I can like break up my day and have something to look forward to after 3 hours of like intense, whatever it will be, or even not intense, could be like, as in my days are very, very varied and they're often not doing things that most founders would say are like, you're working really hard as a founder, but my brain is still occupied by Picnic like 90% of my waking hours. But I, because of that, and because I know that that is true, I actually allow myself the freedom now to spend as much time as I want in my waking hours doing things that are not just desk soul destroying, typing away, like things that make basically, and it might also be partly because I just, you know, I don't know if, I've never been tested for things like ADHD and I don't want to use that as an excuse because maybe I don't have ADHD, but it wouldn't surprise me if I have some sort of like ADHD. But even if I don't, I'm the kind of person who learns best and kind of works best in a very particular way. And I think what I've done over the years is become really kind to myself in actually allowing myself to just work in that way versus forcing myself into this archetype of like, you're a founder, you need to sit at your desk, smash out 10 hours a day, every single day. And if you're not working from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m., then you're doing it wrong. Like, I'm the complete other end of the spectrum to that, where if the one valuable thing I did today was I came up with a really good idea and the rest of my day was absolute crap and I just like did some emails and blah, blah, blah and whatever else, but that one idea could be a 10x idea that like genuinely changes the trajectory of the company, that's a much, much better use of my time than forcing me into a little cube working all day. And then I will miss out on this idea and I'll miss out on this creativity. I'll miss out on the perspective I need to like zoom out of the company a bit and think more strategically. All those things I feel like you can only do if you have to create that structure for yourself and way of working for yourself. And if you just listen to what people say about like, what is a good founder, most things wouldn't say, go for walks all the time, do whatever you want. Like, they probably wouldn't say that. And I quite strongly believe that if that works for you, then you should do that. If your role in the company as well is to to be the ideas man, then you need to allow yourself to come up with your best ideas.
So then it feels like the trait that would be common amongst great founders is the awareness of what works well for you.
Yeah.
And then having the courage and the kindness to build work around how you like to work.
Well, I mean, that is a good question, because my assumption still is that the great founders, I'm not a great founder, I'm just a founder trying to find my way. But the great founders, from what you read online, do sit at their desks all day at 6 a.m. until 10 p.m. and they're just maniacal and whatever. So maybe my version of a founder is not one that leads to outsized returns and to kind of 1,000x multi-billion dollar companies. I mean, I haven't built one myself. So the chances are what I'm saying is only applicable to founders who don't actually care about becoming a multi-billion dollar founder. But in my current version of Picnic, which I'm building towards, where I'm just trying to build a really nice profitable business and grow it over the years, and hopefully one day it does become a really big business, this is the only way I can see doing that. Because over a 10-year horizon, this being a marathon, not a sprint, this is the way I have to do it. Because if not, it's not going to work at all. It just won't go anywhere. I will be miserable. I won't want to work on this, and it will just implode. So it works for me, but also I can't say that's what great founders do, is being aware, because maybe I'm just not cut out to be a great founder, but I'm capable of being a good founder. Or I mean, even the scale isn't just based on the size of your outcome, your exit either, right? Like, to me, success is not the size of my outcome anymore. Success is the impact of the business and my satisfaction and happiness in life. Those are basically the two, and not just mine, but like me and the teams, I would say. Those are the two things I truly care about. And then the third, obviously, being the financial return. And that's the thing that you will want, the financial. Well, maybe some people don't, but I also want a financial return. But I would take a mediocre financial return and these two really nailing it over a mega financial return and then failing miserably at the first two. That's where my balance is now.
But all of the founders that you've seen build billion-dollar companies, they haven't had this priority order?
Well, I don't know, because I don't know a lot of their personal lives intimately enough to know what truly goes on. I think that I would have a bet that a lot more founders than actually acknowledge it do tend to overblow how much they work and how, what kind of work they're doing. And actually, I think there are more people like me out there who just work really hard and really are constantly focused on the business, but what the definition of hard is not sitting at the computer doing that all day. Like, even if I think back to some of the founders I've worked with in the past, maybe no names, some of them did actually live really nice, balanced lives. Well, one in particular lived really, really like an amazing lifestyle, it seemed, but they were working constantly, on the phone constantly, firefighting things constantly, but they weren't at a computer bashing away, sat in an office all day. So, and they are an incredibly successful person. So yeah, it's an unanswered question. I don't actually have the answer to the question. I'm curious to see, but also I'm 33. I suspect over time I'll get to a better sense of what the answer to that question is. At the moment, my hypothesis is that it's possible to be successful and very successful without completely compromising on yourself and your personal life and your mental health. I think it's actually possible, but I might be proven that it's not. You have to just take the hit, and that's only people who are willing to sacrifice all of that are the ones who actually succeed. I don't know the answer though. What do you think?
I think it comes down to the definition of success, obviously. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're trying to become a 100 millionaire, there is, I don't know any example of someone that hasn't had to work stupid amounts of time and sacrifice lots of personal life to reach that goal. And I think more people glamorize that, the end result, without taking into account what's required to get there, and convince themselves that that's what they're going for, without truly understanding the sacrifice, and then get miserable when the sacrifice becomes reality.
Yeah.
And it feels now like a lot of founders are shifting away from this VC high growth, either it goes to the moon or it blows up and we're going to change the world. Yeah. And more towards this, I'm going to build a business that's going to last a long time.
It might get really big one day, but it doesn't have to happen now. And it might take 20 years instead of 10 or whatever.
This has been epic so far, but we're going to have to wrap it up very soon. Lastly, we'd love to help people connect with you personally.
Mm-hmm.
And since I've met you, you've been through the ringer on a personal perspective. Got cancer, split up with your long-term partner. The company almost died, which has a massive personal toll.
Mm-hmm.
How do you look back on the last couple of years?
Well, I guess that's actually probably related to the last topic that I'm talking about, maybe, because I think if all those three things were happening at the same time and I didn't allow myself to like de-stress in ways during work days and whatever, that probably would have been too much. It would have actually led to like proper burnout. But because I was able to just really prioritize myself, it meant that then I could show up really well in work. And actually, it's really crazy to say, but when I didn't have cancer, the company had loads of funding and I was in a happy relationship with my ex. Those three things were all true and the performance of the company was abysmal. Then all three of those things happened and the performance of the company since has been exceptional compared to previously.
Problem solved. No. Break up with your partner, get cancer,
company
success.
That's the lesson I'm trying to say. No, the lesson is the change in how I treated myself because of those major things that happened in my life. Because before that, I was still in the mindset of computer all day, do loads of work. If you're not working hard enough, you're going to fail, blah, blah, blah. I wasn't carving out time in my day to actually look after myself. I was drinking probably a lot outside of work to cope with all of the things going on, the stress that I was creating for myself. But the stress was ultimately coming from being unfulfilled in my work. That was probably the main source of stress at that point in my life, because everything else was probably quite good. But the unfulfilled work-life balance at that point in time, or unfulfilling work that I was doing, was taking such a toll on me. And then I wasn't giving myself a lifestyle that could cope with that, those circumstances. So when those other things happened, that kind of forced me to go, okay, no, now I need to actually take care of my lifestyle, my health, because I have cancer, whatever, and broken up with my ex now. So I'm pretty shaken up by that. And the company's about to die. So, you know, that trifecta turns out very effective motivator to sit down and properly take care of yourself. And basically, the long story short is, since taking care of myself, you can almost track it like month to the month where all of this happened. You can track it to performance today, as everything has improved massively since then. And the company is now on a really good trajectory, and we might actually make it. I don't know. But certainly we've got a really good chance of making it now. And yeah, that's why I wanted to mention that stuff before, because the only change that actually happened was taking care of myself. And I do 10K steps every day now. I'm on like a 314-day streak, which you can track back to when all of this happened. And you can track the company performance basically to that day almost has gone up since then. So doing 10K steps every day, that's something that I do every single day. There's probably been about 4 days I've missed in the last 310. And that was mainly through basically completely fucking my ankle on a hike in Cape Town. One time I probably did just miss it because I was too drunk on a night out, and then I was boozy night out, and then I just like looked at my watch and I was like, oh my god, I've missed 10k steps. But yeah, basically that, taking care of myself, doing 10k steps a day, taking up paddle, my new favorite obsession, and then having like this outlet now to go and be progressing at something, a skill of some kind, and actually like working on that and having lessons and developing in that fun skill, letting out my like competitive side in some other avenue other than just work. Health wise, like I don't drink anywhere near as much at all. I don't eat sugary snacks anymore. But basically those three things forced me to make all of these lifestyle decisions. And, you know, I mean, we tried the accountability group for a while, but I've kind of been doing that even without the group. I've actually been sticking to my goals. And I sat down at the start of this year and wrote all of those goals that I shared with you. But of all of those goals, I'm on target for all of them. It's crazy. Like, I genuinely am on target for all of them, if not already hit some of them. And we're only in July now. So, like, all of that change just from allowing myself in the daytime to not be stuck at a desk working 10 hours a day because it doesn't really suit my working style. But just giving myself the freedom to take care of myself first and then focus on the business, that seems to be too much of a coincidence to me. So I am actually going to credit the success that we're seeing now, not the success of the whole company, but like the direction of the company now shifting is down to, I think, that really. And then also me doing that for the rest of the team as well, like saying, making it okay for everyone else as well to be like that. Which, to be fair, it's never really been like strictly you can't do this, but me leading and showing people like, I'm going to do this in the middle of the day, you're allowed to go and do this too, makes everyone much happier. And if you ask Harry or Sergey or other people on the team, like, I suspect they would say that they also love that dynamic. So I'm basically now a proponent for just letting people work exactly how they want. And that if that is walking around in a park for 2 hours of the day, go for it. Don't feel like you have to just tie everyone down to a desk. That's the hill I will die on now.
Amazing. Wow. What a way to close us off. It's been exceptional. Thanks so much, mate.